visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware: don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, they got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. See, the halibuts and the sturgeons are being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste. Just go out for a breath of air and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe long as you don't inhale. Lots of things there that you can drink, but stay away from the kitchen sink, the breakfast garbage that you throw into the bay. They drink at lunch in San Jose. So go to the city, see the crazy people there, like lambs to the slaughter. They're drinking the water and breathing the air.
This is KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological.
This afternoon, we'll be talking with Chita Chudy, farmer, rancher, and mycologist. And by way of full disclosure, he's our son. He'll be talking with us about the world of fungi, larger and more complicated than you might imagine. And he'll tell us about butte remediation and his efforts to educate people about mushrooms.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County: year-round Wednesday morning in Chico at the North Valley Plaza, Saturday year-round at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico, and a seasonal market Tuesday mornings in Paradise. The Chico Certified Farmers Market, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. We want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views of or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters. We'll be back to talk with Chita Chudy about the world of fungi. This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico.
Sidewalk and on the city streets, there's water in the puddles that I splash beneath my feet. There's water in the air when the day has just begun. Each drop of water on the grass reflects the morning sun. I like water that is flowing, going down a river run. I dive into the breaking waves out in the ocean. I like it when I'm hiking, drink my water cool and slow. I like it when it's hot and bubbling up from down below. From the mountains to the sea,
blue, blue planet.
It's a reason life can be
blue, blue planet.
Water up and water down,
blue, blue planet.
Bringing life the whole world round. There's water on the mountain flowing deep beneath the ground. I I always think of where it's been before I drink it down.
Water is a gift,
bringing life to the land. Each drop's a celebration when you're on the desert sand. And when you're in the jungle in a canopy of leaves, the constant water dripping is a reason life can breathe. And when you're lying on the grass looking to the sky, water flows around the world in clouds rolling by.
From the mountains to the sea,
blue, blue planet.
It's a reason life can be
blue, blue planet.
Water up and water down,
blue, blue planet.
Bringing life the whole world round. Hey, Marine Mark, make that guitar tell us about the water. Let the water flow. Yeah. And when the day is gray, the fog is floating on the wind. I breathe it out again, and then I breathe it out again. Water is inside of me, this is how I know. I see the vapor in my breath when I'm sliding in the snow. Water is inside of us, we're in it from the start. The pool of water in our eyes are wellsprings of the heart. Water is a part of us in all we do and say. Our joy in life and living lifts us up like bursting spray.
Blue, blue planet.
From the mountains to the sea.
It's a reason life can be
blue, blue planet.
Water up and water down,
blue, blue planet.
Bringing life the whole world round,
blue, blue planet.
Been torn apart, got so many scratches and scars. Maybe they won't all go away, but they'll fade. Maybe time can mend us together again. It's not what we've done, but how far we've come. We've been walking through.
Well, we're having a little trouble reaching our own homestead. Can't get Cheetah to answer the phone. So we're going to start a replay. This is Michael Briand. He's talking about Beyond Liberalism, and we had planned to run this in another week. It's particularly appropriate with the change of chief executives, but it talks a little bit about how we can go beyond just mouthing platitudes and really engage in action. Here's Michael Briand.
Start it.
Should start. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Tonight we're speaking with Michael Briand, author of a new book from Prager entitled Beyond Liberalism Toward a Purpose-Guided Democracy. He's director of the Ethics and Deliberation Project at Civic Evolution, a not-for-profit educational software developer. He's spent 30 years working at the levels of both theory and practice on the challenges of enhancing citizen participation in democratic self-governance, with an emphasis on conflict resolution and high-quality public discourse. Welcome to Ecotopia, Michael Briand.
Thank you, Stephen. I appreciate very much having the chance to talk a bit about the book.
Okay. We're going to start by quoting briefly from the preface where you write, "In a liberal democracy, people have to be able to live together despite their differences and disagreements. But in our country today, democracy is marked by intense, intractable, interminable political conflict. We're not solving problems. We're not getting things done. We're spending too much time and energy fighting with each other." Well, I guess our big question is, how did we get to this state of affairs?
Well, the short answer, I suppose, is the same way we get old, one day at a time. It's been a long time coming, but especially over the past 50 years or so, we've allowed our public life, our political life in particular, to deteriorate in ways that, if we'd been paying better attention, we might have been able to prevent. I say might have been able because it's an important part of my argument that there was a flaw in liberal theory from the very beginning. That flaw wasn't obvious back in the 18th century, of course, when people were excited and energized by the new thinking that came with the start of the modern age.
Can you give us maybe a little help with definitions and with history? What is liberalism?
Yeah, liberalism is the set of beliefs, principles, institutions, and so on that constitute essentially the modern worldview that gave us the outlook on life we take for granted. For example, that includes democracy, science, capitalism, aspects of life that are so familiar to us we can't even imagine how things could be otherwise. Originally, though, liberals were people who objected to traditional institutions and practices like hereditary privilege, monarchical government, official state religion, the role of the church in politics, and the mercantilism that Adam Smith wanted to see replaced by free market capitalism.
So who were the principal architects of this? I have to say I'm a big fan of John Locke and once wrote a article for the English teaching journals of books too good to miss, and it was Locke's essay concerning human understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John Locke is probably the best known of liberalism's intellectual architects. But liberalism as a whole emerged during the Cultural Revolution we know as the Enlightenment, roughly mm-hmm. from the middle of the 17th century to the middle of the 19th. A bit earlier, of course, during the Renaissance in Europe, people had begun thinking again about the ideas and institutions of the classical age, such as the development of democracy in ancient Athens, which they had largely ignored all through the medieval centuries. In turn, though, the Renaissance led to the Reformation with its emphasis on the direct relationship of the individual to God. You mentioned Locke, and of course he argued that the individual person has a natural right to life, liberty, and property, and the government has no justification for violating these rights, a view that's clearly echoed in the Declaration of Independence. Probably the other intellectual founder one that's most widely known to people is John Stuart Mill in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And so what did liberal democracy free people from? And what have been the achievements of liberal democracy, which I kind of like?
Well, there are a lot of good things about liberalism, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we go along. But originally, liberals, you know, whether you're starting from Voltaire and Montesquieu all the way through Mill and John Rawls in the 20th century, have always placed a high priority on liberating people's minds from ignorance, superstition, arbitrary authority, and so on. They've given liberalism its emphasis on a host of things that we take for granted. I've mentioned science, democracy, and capitalism already, which includes free economic markets, but also individual rights, legal and political equality, and the familiar freedoms of speech, press, religion, and economic activity, among others. These are also part of liberalism's legacy and good things that we don't want to get rid of.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael Bryan, let's jump to the central thesis of your book. What's the root cause of the problems that have been created by in public life today by that liberal democratic theory?
Well, it's painfully clear, I think, to just about everybody now that democracy in the U.S. today is marked by bitter, divisive, and above all, unproductive political fighting. That's a big problem, because if we can't even talk to one another, how are we going to make sound decisions about public policy? How are we going to solve the host of challenges we're facing, some of which are really big and urgent? But there's also a deeper problem here. Not long ago, the writer Andrew Sullivan pointed out that although liberalism has improved life greatly for many people, and it continues to do so, and although people continue to believe in the promise of freedom, prosperity, and happiness, it's dogged by what he termed a nagging question. Is this freedom, this prosperity, this technology, etc., that we enjoy, is this all there is to life? Despite the obvious benefits it's made possible, health, wealth, security, peace, and so on, liberalism has left us with a hunger for a shared public conception about the purpose of life. So we're facing two major problems in our country today, and in the Western world more generally. One is that political conflict threatens to pull our society apart. The other is that we don't share a national purpose that gives meaning to our lives. And these two problems are related. Both grow out of the same source, namely the idea of individualism that historically liberalism brought with it. Why is individualism problematic? Because ultimately the quality of life in our country comes down not to this or that policy or to whose programs will be more effective and efficient or to who's right and who's wrong, but to this fact that none of us will put aside our preoccupation with what's good for us personally and ask instead what's good for everyone. It's our embrace of individualism, I argue, that's responsible for this preoccupation.
I'm going to diverge a little bit from what we planned. Is that liberalism's problem, or is that the problem of a society that has become much more diverse, much more complex, that has many more sources for ideas, many ways that ideas come into the marketplace of ideas? It seems to me that and I'm going to use the word tribalism, has had a huge impact on the breakdown of our ability to have common ideas, common values, a common conception of the good of the community, because we're so diverse.
Well, you're certainly right that spontaneous changes in the world, the emergence of technology, especially you know, in the last 20 years or so, have played an important role in the problems and the negative aspects of our public life today. But in each case, I think you have to ask the question, well, why did that happen? What's the source of that? And I think you can trace all of the things that we complain about, such as our unproductive political discourse back to the basic flaws in individualism, which historically came with liberalism. And I wrote the book in large part to show how we can't really understand a lot of the difficulties that we're trying to make sense of and respond to without being aware that the source goes all the way back to some fundamental assumptions we make about life that just aren't visible to us because we take mm-hmm. them so much for granted.
Like fish and water.
You talk about the concept yep. of atomism and subjectivism in the book. Perhaps you could explain those to us, please.
Yeah. Well, you know, individualism encompasses several distinct ideas, but two of them have really seriously undermined liberalism's success and its potential. The first, as you say, is what I call, and others call, atomism. This is basically the idea that we're fundamentally separate and self-contained creatures, individual social atoms, I guess. It says each person has his or her own unique personality, experiences, abilities, needs, priorities, and so on. Except through family ties and relationships that we enter into voluntarily, we're not connected to each other in any meaningful or important way. But instead of seeing atomism for what it is, an artifact of a simplistic 17th century conception of scientific thinking that's been misapplied to the human world, we've simply accepted it. As a result, we've blinded ourselves to the damage we've done to the connections that once bonded us with others. Traditionally, you know, a person's identity was tied to the place where he was born and raised and to the other people with whom he shared a history, language, a religion, and an outlook on what life is and how it should be lived. But since roughly the end of the Civil War, and especially after the Second World War, our identities have been increasingly undermined by the uprooting of people and the breaking of connections to family and place. These days, we're more likely to think of ourselves as discrete, self-sufficient individuals who are also self-made. We base our identities on the education we've had, the career success we've enjoyed, our personal interests and passions, and increasingly on our partisan political views. But these things just don't work as well as traditional sources of identity. And the result, I think, is a widespread identity crisis. The other flawed element of liberal individualism is what I call subjectivism. It's less fundamental than atomism, but it's more troublesome because it lies closer to the surface of our political disagreements. Subjectivism holds that the truth of evaluative propositions, in other words, statements asserting that something's good or bad, right or wrong, the truth of such statements is individually or subjectively determined. Because we're supposedly separate and unique, as atomism tells us we are, there can't be any objective standard or criterion of value that everyone can appeal to in order to compare and rank different values. All we have is our desires, and subjectivism says we just have to take them as a given. So, for example, if you go in for classical music and my taste runs more to heavy metal, there is no way to argue that classical music is in any sense better than heavy metal. It's just a matter of personal taste. And our judgments about what are good, because they're matters of taste, can't be questioned. They're immune to challenge. So when we get to ethics and politics, subjectivism says we can't compare one person's goals to another and then rationally decide as a society that the goals of one person should be assigned priority over another person's. And because there's no interpersonally valid, that is, objective standard of good and bad, right and wrong, each person has to be allowed the freedom to choose whatever goals he or she wants to pursue, irrespective of the consequences for the well-being of others. Irrespective because people's desires have to be accepted for what they are, and we can't compare them. Freedom, or laissez-faire, we might say, becomes the only rule for resolving disagreement that we can agree on. But because we've elevated free personal choice to the status of ultimate ethical and political authority, over time, democracy itself, which requires self-restraint and compromise and making hard choices, has come to be seen as an encroachment on individual freedom and a threat to the individual's self-defined happiness. This is how, in my view at least, liberalism undermines democracy and has done so since the very beginning.
We'll pick up on the whole question of establishment of standards and values and a little bit further on in the show. I did want to ask you, however, Michael Bryan, you use in this interview and in the book, you use the first-person plural pronoun, we, considerably, pretty frequently. And I was thinking back to my days in church as a kid where my minister would say, we are unworthy in thy sight, O Lord. We have committed sins of omission and commission. And even as a kid, I balked at this. I said, what do you mean, we? Who is this we? And perhaps you could tell us, who's the we in your book? Am I really part of that we, or can I find a way to wiggle out of it?
Well, you know, I think it's symptomatic of the individualism I'm talking about that the question even arises, what is this we? Because we tend to think of ourselves first and foremost, and a lot of times exclusively as I. And that's part of where the problem comes. As I've just said, we means all of us in this country, all Americans. And yes, we do refuse, all of us, to build our political beliefs, attitudes, and actions around the habit of thinking and talking ethically, because none of us regularly participate in inclusive, open-minded, mutually respectful dialogue and deliberation. We don't routinely make a good faith effort to weigh and balance our different values and priorities with a view to doing what's best for everyone. We don't because we can't. That kind of process in practice just doesn't exist. In fact, it exists nowhere in the modern liberal world as far as I know. So are we all complicit? Yeah, you and me included. Some of us may be more complicit than others, but complicit nevertheless.
You write that the fundamental question of ethics is, how should we live? Liberalism treats this question as one that each of us individually must answer. Why is that a problem? I think you've hinted at this already, but I'm kind of looking for how we get from isolated individualism to an individualism that might come to agreement about some elements of ethics.
Right, and of course, a large part of the challenge is that this assumption about the nature of our individual selves is so deeply embedded that it requires a kind of a gestalt shift in our consciousness, and that's something that doesn't happen, as quickly as a gestalt shift does, but more slowly, like a paradigm shift, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But let me start with this question, which I've said is the basic one for ethics. How should we live? This isn't something each of us individually can determine for all of us collectively as communities and as a society. Atomism and subjectivism mislead us into thinking that we could just add up every individual's answer to the question, how should I live? And get the answer to what is a very different question, how should we live, or what kind of society or community should we be? Obviously, as an individual, I can't answer for all of us. Only we collectively can do that. The problem is, liberalism denies that there can be any answer to the question, what kind of society or community should we be, other than one that's formulated in terms of what each of us individually wants or desires. Liberalism's idea of a collective, quote, decision, unquote, is a market-like outcome where individual preferences are just lumped together and called a decision. We see this in our reliance on polls and voting as a substitute for the hard work of building consensus through dialogue and deliberation. But more fundamentally, liberalism doesn't deal realistically with our need as human beings for a persuasive and animating vision of our place and purpose in the great scheme of things. As a culture, we don't acknowledge the basic human need to live with a sense of purpose and direction. Incidentally, George Orwell once said that fascists like Hitler and Mussolini understood this better than liberals do. So it takes a village, so to speak, to create and sustain a village of, a vision of purpose beyond our individual satisfaction. It just can't be accomplished by pursuing our strictly personal aims. Feeling that we're part of some great cause, enterprise, or project that stands for something true and of enduring importance is an inherently collective undertaking. So yes, only physical persons can answer the question, but only in their role as participants in a public dialogue who face the task together of answering the question, what is our purpose in life as a society and as communities? Now, another reason why it's crucial for us to ask this question is that our ability and willingness to address the more immediate question, how should I live personally and as an individual, depends on it. If we don't live in a society that takes seriously the question, how should we live, how many of us will even be aware that the question, how should I live, is a question we should ask ourselves? How many of us are going to realize it's a question we even can ask ourselves? The point is, without a society that enables and encourages us to reflect together on the question, how should we live, precious few of us are going to give a whole lot of thought to the question, how should I live? Instead, we're more likely to be content with living the way we're told to live, or the way we're manipulated into living, or the way everybody else lives. That's the perpetual dream of totalitarian governments and marketing managers everywhere. We can't develop our individuality. In other words, we can't flourish in our uniqueness as individuals if we don't inhabit a social environment in which the asking of the collective question, how should we live, gives us an incentive and sets an example for each of us to ask the personal question, how should I live?
You also say that liberal democracy undermines both the conflict-resolving public discourse upon which democracy depends and our ability as individuals and as a society to reflect and pursue a meaningful life. How do we create a public discourse that meets the kinds of goals that you're talking about? It feels right now to me that it's really difficult for people to talk to each other, not just about how to create a meaningful life, but about what we should value and what we care about. So how do we create opportunities for a meaningful discourse in the age of Trump? And can we have a meaningful public discourse at this point in our history?
Well, I think the good news is that as long as there are people, there will be talk in public between members of the public. It's a matter of willing ourselves to talk in the way that I've characterized as public ethical dialogue and deliberation. Now, it's certainly not impossible to think and talk together in a way that recognizes our need for a sense of communal purpose and meaning, or to talk about what things we value and what priority we ought to assign them. Whether we can succeed in doing so, though, I honestly don't know. There are immense obstacles. Our materialism, our narrow conception of knowledge, the baser needs and proclivities of our species. But there's one thing that seems manifestly clear to me, at least, and that's if we don't try to improve the quality of our discourse, it probably won't happen spontaneously, at least not anytime soon. Now, as for meaningful discourse in the prevailing political atmosphere, it's a matter, I think, of carving out public spaces where people who are willing to participate in public ethical dialogue and deliberation can do so. It's not going to occur in the broadcast media or online. It's not going to occur at the state or national levels of politics, mm-hmm. or even in public arenas at the local level. If it's going to prove possible, it'll be at the grassroots in spaces that people create just for that purpose.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Michael Bryant about his new book, Beyond Liberalism Toward a Purpose-Guided Democracy. So far, we've mostly explored his view of how liberal democracy has failed us or set us on the wrong track. In this segment, we'd like to go a little bit further. One of the statements you made that I found particularly interesting was that, quote, objective ethical judgments can be achieved if we understand that insofar as they support the fulfillment of empirically identified human needs, statements about good and bad are propositions of a factual nature. That kind of goes against everything that we've been concerned about, the reign of idealism, atomism, and subjectivism. How do we get to statements that are propositions of a factual nature that deal with questions of good, evil, and ethics?
You mean how do we get an is from an ought?
Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. That's that's been the mantra for some of the philosophical underpinnings of liberalism over the past three centuries. But first, let me distinguish between an evaluative statement that's objective and one that's factually true. A statement like education is good or people should pursue an education is objective if, first, it's justified from the point of view of everyone who's affected by the issue and the way it's resolved, and second, if it's justifiable from the point of view of anyone who doesn't actually participate in discussing the issue, provided that, third, people have thought about the issue and the options for resolving it in the conditions that are optimal for making a sound choice. Now, what are those conditions? Well, there are half a dozen of them. I'm not going to mention all of them, but the crucial one to understand is the requirement that each participant adopt the ethical point of view. We do that by working toward what I call mutual comprehension. In other words, we all try to comprehend, to understand and appreciate each other's needs, values, priorities, experience, and so on. Now, the requirement that everyone adopt ethical point of view means that ethical thinking is an inherently collective, or as I use the term in the book, polylogical process. That is, it's an activity that necessarily requires the inclusion of multiple perspectives on the issue. Only an inclusive community of decision makers can produce objective judgments. As I said earlier, we can't reach objective judgments as individuals because we're like the blind men in the fable about the elephant. None of us sees all of reality. No one knows the full truth. We can know what's objectively good and right, but we can know it only by integrating our individual partial perspectives with those of others through the objective medium of language, which itself is something we can create only collectively. Now, an evaluative statement can not only be objective, but also factually true. For example, it's not good for children to play with matches. That's an evaluative statement. Well, why isn't it good for children to play with matches? Well, because it might start a fire. They might get burned. Burns cause pain. Pain's not good. Burns can create the possibility of infection, which is hazardous to their health. Is it just my opinion or yours that it's not good for children to play with matches? Somebody might claim it's good for the health of a human being to eat a healthy diet that includes vegetables. Is that factually true? Well, if we consider all the relevant evidence, if we assess that evidence and rely only on findings that are valid and reliable, if we consult experts and authorities on diet and health, if we take everybody's perspective into account, and if we reason carefully among ourselves about what we can justifiably infer from our analysis of the evidence, it's perfectly reasonable to say it's a fact that eating a healthy diet that includes vegetables is good for the health of a human being. In other words, it's good for anyone to follow such a diet. And because it's factually true that eating a healthy diet that includes vegetables is good for the health of anyone, we can go straight to the conclusion that any human being should follow such a diet. Now, we have to add the qualifier immediately, prima facie, on balance, and all things considered. Because it's possible in a particular set of circumstances that maybe it isn't good for someone in particular to follow such a diet. If you've got Crohn's disease or irritable bowel syndrome or you've just had intestinal surgery, then for you, in your circumstances at this time, it's not good and you shouldn't eat them. That's why I say it's good for anyone. The point is, it's a factual question whether something's good because the answer in principle is discoverable. A lot of evaluative issues, including ethical ones, are difficult to resolve in practice, but that doesn't mean they can't be resolved in principle. Now, one last thing before I let you go on to the next question. The reason evaluative statements like the ones I've mentioned are factual questions is the question of whether something is good depends on another factual question, and that is, what do human beings need? If we think a while about why we have the word good in our language, it's because we want to be able to identify, evaluate, approve, and recommend things that help us meet our needs. Good doesn't mean that which meets our needs. Rather, good is what in fact meets those needs. The work that's been done on human needs and human flourishing since Abraham Maslow in the 60s makes it clear that it's good, it's valuable for human beings to be able to meet their needs. And the more basic the need, the more good is generated by fulfilling it. So it's an empirical question whether a condition, action, activity actually contributes to fulfilling a need. It's not just anyone's opinion. And this is enough, I argue, to let us at least begin talking with each other in a more constructive, productive fashion about what's good for people.
If we're working, I'm diverging again, but if we're working with grassroots, not on a city level or a governmental level, but we're working in the public sphere with small groups of people, and if that group is diverse, culturally diverse, ethnically diverse, how does that happen? Because the standards, as you said, you know, subjectivity is the means by which people begin anyway by making assessments, and is often subject to the community from which they come. And so how do you develop the processes that allow for all of that diversity? I mean, even in diet, even in something like diet, what's good? You know, by Western standards, you have certain things that scientists have told us, but that's not universal.
Well, I would disagree with the claim that what constitutes a healthy diet is not universal. Because healthy, as I've discussed it, is a function of something that is universal. And that is the needs that we have evolved as a species since the very beginning. It's not only Maslow, but people like Professor Schwartz in Israel, who've identified a number of needs that are in fact universal, that they're invariable across societies. And Schwartz, I recall from his study, he looked at people in more than 70 countries, I believe. The way that we go about trying to fulfill our needs, that is so diverse that there is probably no coming together on that question. But if we can get to the factual issue of what in fact meets basic human needs, again, that can give us a place to start talking more constructively.
So this is really at the large philosophical level. When we get down to the nitty-gritty...
That's my level.
So how do you see it working practically? You know, you talk about, you say that you recognize cultural or differences are essential to having these conversations, but some people don't have access to all of the knowledge. So what happens then? I'm just trying to move from the large philosophical issue to how this works in practice in a very diverse society, like at least those of us in the Western world live, maybe less so in Asian countries.
Well, first, let me get a plug in from my book from 20 years ago, Practical Politics, Five Principles for a Community That Works, which is much more practical in the sense that it does try to address some of these questions. But I'm not going to try to avoid that. I think the point is that we begin where people are. You can begin with any group of people. What's important is to try to be inclusive in terms of the perspectives on the issue that's causing conflict. No group is going to be such that we can have a skillful, passionate, well-informed advocate physically present in a face-to-face conversation so that we have all the blind men, as it were, around the elephant. But particularly in this day and age, with our access to information online, it doesn't take a whole lot of effort to go out and find what the various perspectives on an issue are, and to introduce them into a conversation, even if it's only half a dozen people. Important things are to follow the procedures that I spell out as constituting public ethical dialogue and deliberation, and to respect these and to fill in where there are gaps. Each group can link up with other groups, and this can continue laterally indefinitely. And I, even a number of years ago, sketched a process by which we might have grassroots forums, locally in communities, and then have people select delegates or representatives to meet together in regional groups, and finally statewide groups discussing the same issue. So, the mechanics of it are not unknown. We can figure out how to do that. The far bigger problem is to convince people that it is possible, at least in principle, to work toward an objective ethical judgment without compromising the diversity, the pluralism that we value in our society.
Right.
But it does require effort. It does require work, and it requires, above all, a belief in the possibility of doing it. And in large measure, that's what my book is, after the initial discussions of what's wrong with liberalism, is an argument that we can, in fact, do this, or at least make a lot of progress toward it.
I'm not certain that this example is entirely relevant, but as you may know, Michael, the town near us, Paradise, was destroyed in a catastrophic fire November 8th. And interesting, a number of groups are coming together, groups that didn't traditionally talk to one another, to talk about what's the future of this particular town. And a lot of thoughtful dialogue going into it. It's a lot of it on a concrete level. What do we do with the forest? What do we do with building standards? But a lot of it, it seems to me, has gone beyond immediate survival and might be one example of the kind of productive dialogue that you're calling for.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because it shouldn't take disaster of the sort that befell Paradise for people to talk in this way about the kind of community that they want to have.
Right.
The values that they want to have, the priorities, their vision for a healthy, good community life, and so on and so forth. I think the problem is the rest of us are in this sort of slow motion disaster in the making.
Yes.
We have all got so many problems on the horizon that in various ways are almost as severe or more severe as a devastating fire that we're all going to have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't take being in a crisis where we have no choice but to talk with one another and no choice but to put aside our narrow selfish interests for us to recognize that we can't avoid things like this, and we certainly can't recover from them unless we approach each other and we approach politics not as a competition to get our own way about what we want most, and start thinking about ourselves not as these social atoms but as members of a dense network of human beings who absolutely depend on each other for everything, and to understand that the essence of ethics is this, I think you could call it the golden rule. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but basically it involves putting yourself in the position of other people, trying to understand and appreciate what's important to them, and then weighing and balancing what they need with what you need. It's not altruism. You don't exclude what's important to you. You just put it on the same level in terms of importance. And from the habit of talking this way, we can strengthen our civic relationships. You know, it's just like a personal relationship, say a marriage or a partnership. It's got to be strong enough to contain the inevitable disagreements that are going to come up. If you aren't putting effort in to building that relationship and keeping it strong, doing the things that keep you wanting to live with another person, pretty soon your respective individual priorities are going to start to seem like a zero-sum game. And when that happens, people fight for every scrap and every inch, even at the cost of destroying the relationship. And I would say that, in general, politics in the United States, less so at the local level, but, you know, it reflects the national level, too.
Yes, it does.
It's kind of like one of those relationships where we're ignoring the quality of the relationship and just going at it tooth and nail, and in the end, we're going to find ourselves without each other.
You call at the end of the book for something called ethical heroism. And as we close this discussion, perhaps you could tell us, what is ethical heroism? What does it require? How can we get to it?
Well, by ethical heroism, you know, that's a word that I use judiciously, because, you know, we do have some good sense about what a hero is, but I think when it comes to ethics in our public life, there aren't very many of us who are willing to be one. By ethical heroism, I mean having the conviction and commitment to contributing to the resolution of ethical issues. And by the way, most political issues, or I would argue all of them, have an ethical issue at the heart of them. Contributing to the resolution of these issues by participating in ethical dialogue and deliberation. And when you're not actively engaged in it, committing yourself to thinking about ethical issues as if you were engaged, weighing and trying to balance what's good for you with what's good for others, so the result is what's best for all. But I think if you look at the way we live in terms of our, we divide ourselves into our political selves, ourselves at work, in business, or the professions or whatever, we're constantly putting those narrower demands on us, the values that they embody and the priorities that they reflect, in front of our most general, most fundamental ethical requirement, which is to adopt the ethical view, to understand and appreciate, to comprehend others, and to try and weigh and balance our conflicting interests, values, needs, priorities, and so on.
There's much more to the theory than we've been able to discuss in this hour. We'd strongly encourage our listeners to get a copy of Beyond Liberalism. It's published by Prager. It's available through the publisher on Amazon. Michael, we've totally enjoyed the conversation. You've challenged a number of our traditional assumptions, and we're thinking about the world differently as a result of our conversation with you. Thank you so much for being on Ecotopia with us this evening.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been a pleasure.
And I try to make this kind and clear, just a chance that maybe we'll find better days. 'Cause I don't need boxes wrapped in strings and designer love and empty things. Just a chance that maybe we'll find better days. Forget.
simple where we could live, and something only you can give, and that's faith and trust and peace while we're alive. And the one poor child who saved this world, and there's 10 million more who probably could if we all just stopped and said a prayer for them.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico.
Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we'll hear Bobby Tryon and North State Give and Take, all about local nonprofits, community organizations, and people doing things and being part of a solution.
Also, be sure to check KZFR.org programs to learn about our wide-ranging public affairs programs covering local news, social and political issues from local to global, peace, the environment, personal health. KZFR, your community radio station.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com and listen to our shows, check our podcasts, go to ecotopiakzfr.com.
You are the new day. If you can but prove to me you are the new day, send the sun in time for dawn, let the birds all hail the morning, love of life will urge me say, you are. Knowing we must bear thoughts occur that this night might stay yesterday. Thoughts that we as humans small could slow words and end it all lie around me.
Coming up next is North State Give and Take, and it's made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Kenny Nursery and Topsoil. Celebrating 50 years of providing bulk soils, organic fertilizers, high-octane soil amendments, and a large selection of landscape materials. Kenny Nursery and Topsoil specializes